Hi everyone, I'm Utkarsh, the founder of Network Capital, here to welcome TN Hari, who's the head of HR at Big Basket, in addition to being an author, investor, teacher, and he wears many hats. Today's discussion is going to focus on building a portfolio of careers and deconstructing Hari's very interesting career throughout the decades. So welcome to Network Capital, Hari.
Thank you, Utkarsh. Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So, Hari, how do you describe yourself? Suppose somebody comes up to you these days and say, hey, Hari, what do you do?
So I do multiple things at any point of time, particularly at this point of time, I'm involved in multiple things. And that's the fun part, you know, getting to, you know, do multiple things simultaneously, meeting different types of people. So, for instance, at one level, I'm a CHRO at Big Basket. At one level, I'm, you know, active advisor at some of the venture capital firms in India, an early stage VC fund, a late stage VC fund. I also keep writing books. I'm a mentor at accelerators like Techstars, Silicon Road, and a few others, and also a sounding board for many young entrepreneurs. So I do multiple things and have been enjoying myself thoroughly, Utkarsh.
Was this always your career like? Were you always interested in many things?
No, not at all. So this career, you know, in some ways unfolded gradually. And I actually find it interesting the way it actually unfolded. And to start with, you know, as a kid, I did have some idea about what I was really good at, what I was passionate about, and, you know, pursued my studies accordingly. For instance, I was very passionate about science and particularly physics. And I continue to be passionate about physics even to this day. Feynman's lectures in physics are still around. You know, I keep opening those pages once in a while, hoping to understand some things a little better. Quantum mechanics, cosmology. I have been watching hundreds and thousands of videos on physics. I think YouTube is such an amazing new channel that you get to learn a lot. So I think physics was a very strong interest of mine. And then I realized at some point that maybe, you know, making a career and a living through science in India is not as easy as, you know, making a living out of, for instance, engineering. So I compromised a little bit. And within physics, you know, mechanics and kinematics was of interest to me. And therefore, I pursued mechanical engineering. And as I pursued mechanical engineering, I also realized I'm interested in economics and a few other things. You get exposed to, you know, some of these subjects a little later in life, because what happens is that in school, in India particularly, the education is very narrow. You are taught, you know, history in a particular way. You are taught sciences, and you have no exposure to economics, for instance. Even history is taught in such a boring way. History is today a passion with me. I just love history. A lot of what I write in management draws lessons from history. Sailing Through a Storm, Making a Crisis Work for You, the book that I wrote during the pandemic, draws extensively from history, a lot of lessons from history. So history is taught in such a bad way in school that students don't develop a liking for that. It's much later in life that you realize what you've missed. So after you know, my bachelor's in mechanical engineering, I decided to pursue an MBA, not because I wanted to run away from engineering, but because I wanted to get a more holistic understanding of how companies run. And even after doing an MBA, I went back to a job on the shop floor. So heavy engineering in Tata Steel was what, you know, I took up. And then I'll come back to a few things. But broadly, yes, I didn't do many things. That it's only the last 6 years that I've been doing many things. I have realized a lot of my dreams. I have been able to leverage a lot of my strengths. I've been able to fulfill a lot of my dreams in the last 6 years. And it started off in a very small way. I didn't even hope that many of my dreams and, you know, hidden talents will ever get fulfilled. I thought they will just remain as mere hobbies and never be part of my mainstream life. But the way it unfolded, that's so exciting. I mean, that's something I really want to talk a little more about as we progress in the conversation.
Yeah, we want to hear more about how you decided to really pursue your dreams despite having a very successful career in a way. So was there a nagging feeling inside that you could do more? Or did you feel that, okay, now that I have a certain amount of success under my belt, I can finally experiment? Can you explain the thought process to us?
Yeah, it's a combination of things, Utkarsh. I think beautifully you captured a couple of them. One is, you know, sometime in 2015, I joined Big Basket, and then I realized that, you know, I've been in the startup ecosystem. I'd been in the ecosystem for almost 13, 14 years by then, and I had learned a lot of stuff. And I'm a person, you know, who keeps my eyes, my brains open to lessons. And I always try and connect the dots and look for patterns. So these patterns and lessons are all tucked away in some corner of the brain. I don't go through life, you know, as a set of transactions, not connecting the different transactions. I do connect the transactions, may spot some patterns. So I'm that kind of a person. So I realized that there are a lot of young entrepreneurs, and India's ecosystem suddenly seemed to have taken off. It reached a tipping point. And then I realized, you know what, I'm in a unique position where I've had a ringside view of the evolution of the ecosystem for 13 years. So why not share some of my lessons? So I just began writing. And, you know, I used to always write well since my school days. My English teacher actually thought I'll pursue literature. Right. And she was shocked when she found that I was pursuing science, because she had no clue that I was interested in science as much probably as literature, even more. And so writing well was always a strength of mine. And it played a role in my career in little ways. For example, the way you communicate in meetings, the way you construct your thoughts, the way you articulate, the way you write, and even ordinary things like emails, the way you communicate overall, I think plays a big role in shaping your career. And it did play to that extent, shaping my career played a role. But then it was never such an important one. So I realized that, you know, why not let me start writing about my experiences in the startup world? And I then began writing on LinkedIn. And my writings were not academic at all. So my writing style is very, very down to earth, very practical. You know, it anticipates skepticism. It anticipates questions that people have. It, you know, and responds to many of those proactively. So people can relate to what I'm writing. So very quickly, whenever I'm writing, I'm always thinking about, you know, will it make sense to a practitioner? I'm not writing to a person pursuing a PhD and is just pursuing knowledge. I'm writing to a bunch of people who have a day job to do. Will my writing capture their attention? Will they feel wowed by it? Will they feel that they have something to take away? So that's how I began writing. And then I found it resonated with practitioners and participants in the ecosystem. And then it went on. I began writing slowly, began to write books. And then I realized one of my other passions and strengths was first principles thinking. And then I realized that, you know, I can understand a lot of things using first principles. So, for instance, I wrote this book, which I never thought I will. For example, Diversity Beyond Tokenism. It's neither got to do anything with science, nor has it got to do anything with, you know, management. But it's a topic I found that is very, very relevant to today's times when, you know, companies are paying a lot of superficial attention doing tokenism when it comes to diversity. So I understood this topic and got a co-author and I, you know, together wrote this book. And we talked about, you know, diversity beyond tokenism using first principles thinking, and very, very skeptical about some of the work that organizations are doing, and talked about how companies should be thinking about it. So I think, you know, do things that play to my strength. For example, writing was a strength of mine. Thinking was a strength of mine, using first principles on any topic. So from science to diversity to, I can think of any topic using first principle, economics. So I began writing around using that strength. Then I realized that solving problems is a big strength of mine. So I just became open to listening to people's problems. And I helped, you know, I was a good sounding board. I helped some of them. And then the word of mouth spread. People began reaching out. And that itself, you know, had a cascading effect. So I went on to work as an advisor for some venture capital firms, for some startups. And that's how, you know, gradually, you know, playing to my strengths, it unfolded. This journey unfolded slowly, I would say.
Right. What is first principles thinking?
First principles thinking, to my mind, is about principles that cannot be further broken down. They are reasonably fundamental. I don't know, in science or mathematics, you can call them axioms, which is two parallel lines never meet, right? You don't have to prove that they don't meet. They intuitively so, you know, it's intuitively so obvious that you don't need to prove that. But if you use that, then you can solve many other problems. So taking a set of principles that further cannot be broken down, and those principles, if you understand them well, using those to build upon, higher level ideas and solving problems at a higher level, using those axioms, if you will. I would say axioms are more in mathematics, but in thinking, if you can call them axioms, whatever you may call them, you call them first principles, I think.
Yeah. So we've recently set up a school, and one of the missions of that school is to enable children to think from first principles. It's actually really interesting for you, for us to hear you talk about it, because a lot of us think from analogy and we draw analogies, and that's a great thing, but it shouldn't be at the cost of really building the foundational blocks of knowledge. I write about first principles thinking in my book as well, and like you, I enjoy Feynman quite a bit. Feynman's method of learning, first principle, is so important. In your wide range of experiences in very successful companies, have you noticed that first principles thinking has taken a backseat in the last few years or last few decades? Or on average, do you think people have become better first principle thinkers in whatever you've observed?
I have not seen any pattern in the way things have changed over the years, Utkarsh. I think in the early, I think at all points of time, at least in the last 30 years when I have been active, there were people who could think using first principles 30 years back, and there are people who can think using first principles even now. So I think my own sense is that smart people have always been effective using first principles. And I have been fortunate enough to come across a good number of them at all points of time in my career. I am not in a position to say that this trend has increased, the numbers have increased or decreased, but I think good businesses have always been built by people, I think, who were strong at first principle. All the startups that I've, at least some of them better. For example, I would say I've worked for five startups, all the five of them found very successful exits, and most of them were good at first principles thinking, I would say. Largely, I would say.
So that's really important. I have this theory that on average, because we spend so much time with digital cacophony and we're constantly listening to different analogies and principles, that a lot of us struggle to find alone time. And I think it's so important to become a better first principles thinker, to really process information, process what's going on. And it's my secret hope that in the years to come, all of us can find that quiet time for becoming slightly better at first principles thinking. I wanted to quickly check with you that in your, various experiences that you've had, how did you get interested in people? Because it's not a super common path that I've seen where people with mechanical engineering and an MBA, many of them do go into HR, but it's not common. How did that happen for you?
Oh, I'm as surprised, or at least I was as surprised as you currently are, Utkarsh. So it was by accident that I got into the human capital side of things. So I used to work for this large company called Tata Steel, where I worked on the shop floor. And on the shop floor, it's really about managing people. So that's the most important part of getting work done on the shop floor. However technical the nature of work might be, how much ever expertise you may bring to the table, it's about, getting work done from people that really mattered a lot. But having said that, I think at some point of time post-liberalization in India, many companies were going through a crisis, and Tata Steel also went through an existential crisis. And you had CIS countries that were dumping steel at prices that were below our costs. So we had to do something very dramatic, otherwise we wouldn't have survived. And what were the dramatic things that we could have thought of? For instance, the company offered lifelong employment. Not only lifelong employment, it also offered employment to children of employees that worked for 15 or 20 years. And those kind of cultural principles around which the company was built were not really conducive for competing in the current set of circumstances at that point of time. So we had to do something very drastic, and it wasn't very easy because with such a baggage of culture. Then we got in McKinsey to help us think through some of the principles, and then I was part of the core team that worked with McKinsey as well. And then a lot of the change that we brought about was essentially around human capital. And I found that in a company that is transforming rapidly, human capital can play a very strategic role. And human capital can operate at multiple levels. One is the level at which you can, you know, understand people and motivate people and get a large group of people to work in a, you know, towards a common objective. The other is a very strategic view of, you know, how you should be thinking about people. I think both things matter. So it was, I found that whole exercise very interesting and helpful. And then gradually I realized that a startup is always transforming, is under continuous transformation. And in an organization that is transforming continuously, human capital always becomes very strategic. So that's how I got drawn to it. So intellectually, I was drawn to it. I would say that, you know, my natural abilities with people only, I would say, took shape and got refined in the last 7-8 years. So first, if I was in human capital for the last 22, 23 years, I would say it took shape only in the last 7 years. First 15 years was more of an analytical approach to human capital, a structured approach, a very mathematical kind of an approach, a scientific approach to human capital. But the last 7 years, I became a very humane person. I began to understand the power of humanity and dealing with people, especially the blue-collar workers, in the way they should be dealt with a lot of love and affection. And the fact that dealing with them with love, affection, respect, and taking care of them is actually a big strategic advantage for the business. That's something I began to deeply appreciate only the last 7 years. So I would say my own, you know, human capital journey has evolved. I would say it has taken complete maturity only in the last 7 years. For the first, you know, 14 years, it was a very limited approach. Although it delivered strategic results, somewhere I think it was not complete. Only in the last 7 years, I see it as complete.
Tell us about the difference in both approaches and what prompted this shift from the highly analytical one to the slightly more humane and people-centric one.
Yeah, so I just that will probably require me to talk to you a little bit about the human capital side of things.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, if you just break it up into human capital as, you know, strategic and tactical, and if you say people orientation and business orientation on the y-axis. So on the x-axis, you have strategic and tactical. So you have four combinations, strategic and people, for instance. Strategic and people is about how do you manage change. And people and tactical is about how do you keep people motivated on a daily basis? How do you engage them? How do you respond to their queries? How do you solve their problems on a daily basis? So you have four of these aspects. And gradually I realized that traditionally, a lot of the HR folks, traditionally, they were expected to understand less of business and have more of empathy for the human side of things. I gradually realized they neither had the business understanding, nor did they have empathy for the human side of things. They were more of policy makers and policy pushers. I realized that the human side, understanding people with empathy and sympathy, I would say, and the two are very different, understanding them from both was very, very important. It wasn't very easy. And that is very critical to attain or earn the trust of people. And especially where trust matters, that is very, very important. So for example, if you understand the analytical side of human capital, you will be able to figure out what are the levers, the drivers that are available to you to make your business effective, profitable, sustainable from a people cost and a people, you know, succession perspective. But it will not earn you the trust. Only if you show love towards people and understand their problems and are deeply committed to solving their problems and solving their problems in advance or keeping their priorities ahead of business is actually what will give a push to your business. So that's something it took me some time to realize and hone my skills around that. So purely analytical, no, will not earn you the trust. It will not be a humane organization. At some point of time, things will begin to break. You might have people who are complaining. You might have, you know, a revolt that your practices are not fair. You're not creating a fair working environment. It's not a fair place to work. While you were paying well, there are some things you don't care about. Whereas if you create conditions that are a fair workplace, then many other things in business will automatically take care of themselves. I think this takes some time to understand, especially for analytical minds.
So how did you begin to understand that? Because what you're saying makes perfect sense, but I know that, and everybody knows so many people who practice empathy or who preach empathy but don't practice it, and like, so tell us more about your personal journey.
See, I think part of it comes from personal values and part of it comes from your upbringing. And upbringing, I'm not talking necessarily of family. I'm talking of your early days as a kid in your career. So early days at Tata Steel, I was brought up, you know, to believe that people are important. I mean, if you may not know, Tata Steel is a 120-year-old company. And in those 120 years, there has been not a single case of an industrial relations issue. And that's because of certain principles that the Tatas have always followed. And to this day, they follow those practices. So employees are valued, especially the blue collar workforce are valued a lot. They're dealt with a lot of respect. So somewhere I understood that's important, but I had not imbibed that very deeply. I had not felt that very deeply. And I did not feel that deeply for many years. But only in the last 7 years, I began to, you know, somehow connect the two. When I began working for a company like Taxi for Shop, that's when I experienced blue collar workers in the startup ecosystem. Prior to that, it was all knowledge workers. Right. When you're working with knowledge workers, you don't really feel the need to, you know, you don't, they are not in pain, those kind of knowledge workers. They are well paid. They have a career ahead of them. You know, they are happy people and they can quit a job. They can find another job at will. Whereas blue collar workers, their basic needs are not taken care of. They're not highly respected, you know, by the frontline supervisors. And I noticed that at Taxi for sure in this. And then it began to, you know, touch me a little bit because by nature, I think I have always loved underdogs. I've always supported the underdog at a personal level. And upbringing at Tata Steel, the two things somehow came together. And then I always became a spokesperson for these workers. It's just that I happen to also be the CHRO in these companies. It's just a coincidence. I might have been a spokesperson, even if I was ops head, for instance. So I think it came about because of these things.
But as the CHRO, you do have a lot of sway in defining the culture of a startup or a company. And I think it's so important to have the right culture. And that's, again, something that many people talk about, where very few people get right. So if you were to look at some of the most interesting things you were able to do in the wide range of companies you've been involved with, could you tell us more about what you did and how you decided to act on them?
Right. So I would say, you know, culture is something to a large extent that founders are responsible in a startup. It's a bit of a misnomer or misconception that CHROs play a very important role. They play a supportive role. It all depends upon the personality of the CHRO. I would say in most cases, it is really founder led. So culture in startups almost always equals founders. So founders end up setting the pace, setting up what the company stands for, deciding what the company stands for. So I think that's very important. Second component is that the way you set up culture is the way you demonstrate or live behaviors every day, the kind of behaviors you demonstrate every day. So culture is always, it manifests itself at multiple levels. At one level, the way it would manifest itself are some of the, we call artifacts. For example, a dress code, the way an office, you know, interiors look like, the getup of the office, the kind of policies that a company has, they're artifacts. They don't mean anything. This mean nothing at all. They don't say anything right about the culture of the company. The other component at which, a level at which it reflects is espoused values or stated values. For example, we are a very customer-centric company. Those are printed, posters are put up in boardroom, meeting rooms. They also don't speak anything about the culture. They speak about intent. Whether the intent is translated on the ground is a big difference. The culture is truly reflected at the third level, which is tacit, which is what are the kind of behaviors that are recognized and rewarded by leaders every day? What do leaders do every day? So what they do is what really matters. If my belief is that, irrespective of the size of the company, if 10 to 20 senior most people begin to do two or three things consistently and live those two or three things consistently day after day, then they begin to percolate to the rest of the organization. That eventually becomes the culture of the company because people are always observing seniors and they are seeing what they're doing, not what they're saying. And therefore, what they do on a regular basis begins to percolate. So I think culture, now the question I think you also asked me is, what did I do, for example, when it came to percolating culture? So for example, I've always felt that you should be committed to doing the right things and doing the right thing. Be very transparent in the way you solve problems and the way you approach things. Be transparent in the way you have the kind of policies you have. be honest in the way you implement things. So, for example, we had a POSH policy, prevention of sexual harassment. Every company is expected to have and does have a policy around that. But then what we did at BigBasket was very different. We said that we will implement this policy wholeheartedly across the nooks and corners of the company. 35,000 people across the company, we will implement it. So when a woman joins BigBasket at the smallest dark store or warehouse in any nook and corner of the country, the center head would meet her. He or she would read out the rights to that woman. That leader would read out her rights. He would make accessible all the people to whom she can reach out, their phone numbers, their emails, and show them who are these individuals you can reach out to in case any rights are violated and how to raise a complaint. The internal complaints committee have been constituted. We have received cases where very senior some women complained against very senior people. At some point of time, those senior people were considered indispensable. If they were let go of, the business would have been put back by 6 months to a year. A very senior person in engineering, a very senior person in HR in one of the businesses where it was important to have local connections, and we felt that we couldn't do. In both the cases, in less than 48 hours, we had investigated and let these two individuals go. Because by that, we communicated this message that this is a fair workplace. We are committed to doing the right things, come what may, irrespective of the consequences, short-term consequences in the business, we will do the right thing. And the reason is because the long-term consequences of doing the right thing are always good. Short-term, you might go down a little bit, your journey might suffer, but the intangible advantage, the messages that you communicate both internally and externally are so powerful that in the long term, it's always an advantage. So, for example, doing the right things always. There was one other case where, you know, there was a lady, you know, whose husband committed suicide in the company for some reasons where he was involved in some fraud. He was interrogated until the middle of the night. He confessed and he committed suicide. And his wife sued the company for whatever. And our lawyers had advised the teams that, you know, and she was entitled, because of insurance, he was entitled to receive a sum of 30 lakhs. And, you know, our teams were advised by the best lawyers in the country that don't pay her now because she's already suing you guys. She's approached the police, she's approached the, you know, local government. And if you pay her, you know, she will use that money to sue you further. And I didn't know about this until she wrote to me saying that, you know what, my money has not yet been released. Can you help me? I was shocked to see this. I called up the team immediately and said, is this the way we are going to do things? Is this something that we are going to be proud of? If she goes and talks in a public forum that BigBasket is doing this, are we going to feel proud about it? So we should do things that if it comes in the public domain, we should feel proud about it. And what she does with the money, whether she sues us or she does anything else, that's her business. And if she sues us, we will defend ourselves. But that's no reason not to pay her the money. And lawyers don't run this company. We run this company. We determine the principles by which this company is, on which this company is built. So many things like this, you know, ultimately. So, for example, one decision like this sets the tone for other decisions. So a few key decisions, if you take correctly, if you show people the way you need to do the right thing. And people inherently, I think, are good. They want to do the right thing. They want people at a senior level to stand up for them and show them the way to do the right things. They feel inspired then to do the right thing. What happens mostly is that they don't get these signals. And therefore, after some time, things begin to drift. I think culture is about controlling this drift. It's about giving things a direction and the right direction.
Fascinating. I'm sure in your leadership experience, you've had a wide range of difficult conversations in situations that you've just described. Is there something that you've figured out, or have you gotten better at having difficult conversations?
I think difficult conversations, I have always been easy. You know, it has never been very difficult for me to have these difficult or crucial conversations. Except that over the years, I think I have developed a lot of refinement in the way I conduct these crucial conversations. At some point of time, maybe in the early days, they were a little crude, they were a little rude, and sometimes came across as, you know, personal. So there's nothing personal when you have a crucial conversation around a business-related issue with somebody in the team or anyone in the company, right? But maybe it came across as a bit personal. So I think over the years, I've, you know, attained some degree of refinement in carrying on these conversations, having them in a way that people feel less offended and yet, you know, learn their lessons along through these conversations. But the importance of crucial conversations has never been lost upon me. I've never delayed having these crucial conversations earlier and in the past, but I do it much better now.
Yeah. I mean, just like sticking to the difficult conversations, do you usually go to a difficult conversation armed with all information and proof and data? Or do you often go to the conversations early on to try and so get lay of the land? Do you do both? And the reason why I'm asking this is that, you know, many, many times people are just not prepared to have these conversations because they don't have either the right information or the right mindset, or it gets too personal. So we thought we'll just ask from, you know, the horse's mouth, straight from the horse's mouth.
I think I try and go armed with some degree of information, facts and data. I gather some of the facts and data, but I don't fuss over, you know, spend inordinate amount of time trying to refine the facts and data or trying to find foolproof evidence of something. I get a reasonable sense of the facts and data. And if I feel the topic needs speed and needs to be addressed reasonably quickly, I will do it with speed. I will arm myself with some facts and data, but I will never get lost in analysis paralysis. I will never believe, feel that, you know what, unless I have the, you know, last degree of detail, I can't afford to have this conversation. I am not that kind of person.
Have you had ever made a mistake when it comes to difficult conversations? Perhaps you went.
Yes, I,
to...
I may not be able to give you examples. In some conversations, I think the other person came across, you know, provided some evidence which contradicted my starting point with some of my assumptions. And I learned along the way that the faster, quicker you acknowledge the other person's, you know, acknowledge that the other person is right, then I think it's a great thing. So I think there are a couple of cases where, you know, the other person could produce evidence that showed I was wrong. And I was immediately able to correct myself and say, I'm really sorry. I don't think I got you correct. So let me stand corrected. So I think those things happened a couple of times. And I think what happens if you are willing to correct yourself, and I think this is a broader, you know, thing about saying I was wrong. It's about saying that I don't know. It's about saying I goofed up. It's about saying, you know what, that I don't deserve the credit for this. Somebody else actually did all the hard work, and that person. It's about, you know, being very honest in terms of intellectual honesty, saying I don't know, saying, you know, I was wrong.
I think that's so important. Rethinking and prioritizing accuracy over consistency is critical. And one of the things that on Network Capital we try and do with our community members is to just make it easy to rethink, because you don't need to be definitely wrong. You can change your mind. It's not a sign of weakness, and it's something that should be encouraged more. Now, Hari, tell us a bit about your writing. Because you're somebody who's in the past 6 years, you've been writing extensively, you've been investing, you've been advising, you had human resources for a very large company. What does a day in your life usually look like? And where does writing fit into all of this? How do you create time for it?
So actually, I think I manage my time very well, Utkarsh. I have a lot of free time, you know. A lot of people think that because I do a bunch of things, I am always hard-pressed for time. Actually, I'm not hard-pressed for time. And the reason is there are some principles about time management. And I think over the years, I have pretty much mastered those principles at multiple levels. So I don't do things that other people are supposed to do. For example, in my team, I don't do things that they are supposed to do. And over a period of time, I teach them what I am expected to do so that they learn to do my job reasonably well. So it frees up a lot of my time. So I allow them to falter. I've allowed them to make mistakes. And while making mistakes, they've learned their own lessons. I step in a little later, point out some lessons, and then, you know, they move on and do things on their own. The other thing I do is if there's any initiative, if there is any problem that needs to be solved, I say, get me involved right at the beginning. Don't get me involved halfway through, because then it's too late. We'll have to make mid-course corrections and I'll have to be involved too much, and it's not the right thing. So I involve myself at a very early stage and therefore help set the thinking and the direction. The other thing is that I have learned over the years, you know, about prioritization, which is don't let the little things bother you. So if there are 100 things, figure out, or if there are 10 things, figure out the two things and give them merciless attention. Give them a lot of personal attention. But the 8 things, don't bother. Let them break, let them drop, delegate, do whatever you want. But don't worry too much about those things. Don't worry me at all. But I have my razor sharp focus on those two things. So a couple of these principles, you know, and very quick thinking. I'm generally a quick thinker. So I understand the essence of any issue or any problem very quickly. And I don't meander at all. I get to the thing very quickly. As a result of which, a lot of time is available. Now, when it comes to writing, so it depends upon what I'm writing. There are periods when I don't write at all. So for example, I haven't posted on LinkedIn for almost 8 months, 7, 8 months, nothing at all. I have not posted nothing because I'm busy with other things. And when I'm writing a book, I'm obsessed with the book. I'm spending a lot of time writing. So we just gave in a book to Penguin about a month back. That book is, you know, is in the pipeline. It will take its own time. Penguin has a way of publishing books. And I have no book in the pipeline at the moment. So I'm not writing anything really at this point of time. So I go into intense bouts of writing where I'm writing. So for example, in the last 7 years, I've written 7 books. On an average, 1 year, 1 book a year. It may not be, you know, many, but it's not small either. 1 year book a year is reasonably good. But it's been very, very intense. And every time I've written a book, I have always written based on what I have learned. So for example, when I wrote this book called Saying No to Jugaad, The Making of Big Basket, it was all about the company Big Basket, how it was built uniquely as compared to many other startups in the ecosystem. I was part of this company, so I had everything in my head. So for me, it was just getting the, you know, everything out on paper. And this book called, you know, From Pony to Unicorn is about scaling a startup sustainably. And this is what I had been doing for a living. So it was all about, you know, bringing what's there in the head with some bit of secondary research out on paper. So my writing also doesn't consume too much time because, you know, it's based on lessons that I have actually learned in life. So time management, I think a lot of people think that you need to work very hard. I think you wrote this book, you know, Seductive Illusion of Hard Work. So right. I think that book title appeals to me a lot because I think in many ways it does reflect of what I have been doing this last 7 years. And I've been involved with, you know, not-for-profit organizations. I've been helping some minority communities who are trying to help their women, for instance. So I've been involved with multiple things, doing with fun things, but very, very, you know, focused in a way that it doesn't intrude on my time. I get a lot of time to watch fun videos on YouTube, entertainment, education, you know, everything, news. I'm able to consume. I'm aware. I told you I've watched hundreds and thousands of videos on physics, cosmology, James Webb telescope. I watched every video on James Webb, for instance, that was available on YouTube.
So it's fascinating the way you've described. Two things jump out at me. One is that you learn like an athlete. And that's something, again, we share on NC, that people, knowledge workers, need to work very hard, then rest equally hard, and then start again. So it's not very different from, say, how you prepare for a race, how an athlete prepares for a race. Mm-hmm. And the second is that if you manage your energy well, and if you know when to focus on, I think this time can be managed a little more efficiently. And you've done that, Hari. You've managed to build a portfolio of careers now. And you've achieved a fair amount of success in a wide range of fields. You could be, you know, you could decide to settle down. But in fact, we see that your hunger for doing new things is only accelerating. Do you feel that you're more ambitious today than you were? Or are you differently ambitious today?
I think I'm differently ambitious, Utkarsh. I was never particularly ambitious in my early days. I am not a very traditionally ambitious person, you know, typical of an IIM graduate. So climbing the corporate ladder and becoming a CEO of a mid to a large company was never a goal. So I think I just enjoyed doing things that I enjoyed doing. And somehow it translated into some career moves upwards. And there was an accidental move to human capital, which took me to a completely different area. Again, an accidental move to the startup world, which brought me to this entire community where I've been learning a lot. So a series of accidental moves, which made me realize that, you know, accidents and luck play a very important role in your career. While I think doing the right things, stamina are important, some bit of luck is also very crucial. You can't discount that. So coming to the specific question of are you differently ambitious? Yes, I think I'm differently ambitious. Now my ambition is more about helping the ecosystem, making an impact, helping other people succeed. My success is now entirely for the last few years has been around making other people successful, helping unknown people become big brands, helping unknown people build good companies that they can be proud of. And being an invisible force behind those people has been my ambition.
Right. Over the years, you must have mentored and coached a lot of people and helped them figure out, you know, what they want to do with their lives. What have you learned in the last three decades about mentoring and coaching that is that you thought would be differently true?
Yes, so mentoring and coaching, I think, are terms that are used interchangeably, but some ways they are slightly different. So I would say that my own experience with mentoring, formally mentoring, has not been very old in a sense, maybe probably in the last 12, 13 years or 15 years, I would say. And it has become a little more intense in the last 7, 8 years. And over the years, I think what I have realized is that when you mentor someone, you are always learning from that person as well. So that has been my biggest lesson. And the reason why I think I do well is that I don't even call myself a mentor. I'm a sounding board. And I love talking to a lot of young people. And when I'm talking to them, while they may think that they are learning from me and getting mentored, actually, I'm demonstrating intense curiosity. I'm demonstrating intense learning from them. I'm asking them a lot of questions. I'm letting them talk a lot. And in the process, learning. But in the process of getting them to talk, they feel that their own thoughts get clarified. And they feel motivated and inspired. In between, you know, I do also share my life experiences and my thoughts. But I'm also listening to them very intently, being very curious, deeply, deeply curious. So I think mentoring is something I gradually learned is, you know, always a two-way street. It's never one of, you know, I am here to teach you. That kind of thing never works because it's not true. It's always that you have to keep learning. And if that intent to learn from those interactions exist, then they will in turn learn from you. So I think that's my biggest takeaway from mentoring. And as a result of which I, you know, interact and work very well with a lot of young people. Because when they come to me, I make them feel good about themselves. And I don't make them feel good by being a fake, but by genuinely curious about their life stories, what are they doing differently, exploring. And the very act of exploring, I think, helps them a little bit in their journeys.
For sure. And I think towards that end, suspending judgment is another criteria which I found
correct.
Really
That's
helpful.
Correct.
Before you
very
jump
true.
To a conclusion, it's very important to pause and see whether it adds up or not. Hari, just looking at your wide range of books that you've written, they cover a range of curiosities, I would say, but I see a lot of your writing connected. And one of the ways in which I find your writing interesting is that it builds off of others. So can you perhaps connect the dots? And what we really want to understand through this is how does idea development take place? And how does, say, a brainstorm or a brainwave translate into an article, into a book, into a series of books? And I want our listeners to be able to learn this from you. And maybe, just maybe, first principles thinking has something to do with it.
Yes. So I think, you know, for writing something, you should not believe that you always need the grand strategic idea to write something. My writings have always emanated from everyday life. Everyday life and lessons that everyday life provide are the source of my writing, have been the source of my writings. So for instance, if a meeting didn't go well, it inspires me to put out a blog on why that meeting didn't go well. For instance, let me, I would think a little bit about it, figure out a few insights, and then write about it. So I've always written based on my real life experiences. So when I'm going through this bout of writing, last 7-8 months, I told you I haven't written on LinkedIn, but there were months and years where I used to write regularly on LinkedIn. And those days, every day when I used to go to the office, every interaction was an opportunity to learn. And this is what I keep telling people, you know, strategic lessons in life are not obtained by working in the strategy teams of companies or solving the big strategic problems. Everyday life provides you so many insightful strategic lessons, if only you're willing to keep your mind open to those lessons. Now, coming to specifics, how do they translate into books is a slightly interesting question, because translating to short posts or LinkedIn articles is about those everyday life experiences.
Right.
Now, about books is someday I think you form a view, you know, that this is a big enough team. And I think I have a reasonable understanding of this. I may not know this completely, but it's worth developing that balance. For example, if I know 70%, it's worth spending time and effort to understand the remaining 30% to be able to write a book. So for instance, Saying No to Jugaad was a book I felt I should write, because in the ecosystem, a lot of companies, startups were being built in a way that they were not sustainable. So they were, you know, showing great valuations, funding was becoming the theme, you know, cultures weren't great. So the businesses were not being built in a very sustainable way. And I thought here's a company that's a no-nonsense company, not used to doing, you know, things for the sake of, you know, creating these, I would say, fake metrics, if you will, or...
Right, vanity metrics.
Yeah, vanity metrics, if you will. And we were a company which is doing the things for the right reason always, and never did anything just because it was fashionable to do it. So very thoughtful. So I thought this is a story worth telling, which is that there are no shortcuts to building a business. Some old principles, you know, of thoughtfulness, of doing things for the right reason, of always, you know, building strong foundations before launching anything. They're so powerful. So I thought it's a story worth talking about. So that's how this book came about. Then Saying No to Jugaad, from, you know, Pony to Unicorn was pretty much an obvious choice. So Sanjeev, my co-author, you know, is the founder at Fundamentum Partnership. And he and I had been talking about scaling. We've been meeting multiple companies. So these conversations we've been having. So at some point, we just felt, you know, we know enough to write this book and it'd be helpful for people to learn from this. Diversity Beyond Tokenism, my co-author actually approached me, Swati Jaina. And she approached me because she thought that I would be a good co-author. I could bring some first principles thinking. And we had spoken in the past and we realized we had shared some common understanding on this topic. And when she asked me if I would co-author a book with her, in less than 15 seconds, my response to her was absolutely excited. And this book came out reasonably quickly. So I think, and then at some point of time, I was so fascinated by the blue collar workers and the story of Bharat that I wrote this book, you know, Cutting the Gordian Knot, India's Quest for Prosperity. And the best part of this book was when C. Rangarajan, former, you know, Reserve Bank governor and economic advisor to the Prime Minister, wrote on the cover, a remarkable book to guide the future of India. So I felt very excited. So this was the pain I felt on seeing the blue collar workers in India, the Bharat, the farmers that we interacted, the lives that they led, the privileges that people like us had, the complete lack of privileges and fundamental rights that these people suffered from. And I just felt that there's so much. Their stories need to be brought into mainstream. Why should they appear in an Indian Economic and Political Weekly that nobody reads? Or why should they appear in some vague economics journal which nobody reads? Why can't they be their stories be brought into mainstream? Why can't India's quest for prosperity and India's wicked problems about education, sustainability, you know, all of this be brought into mainstream? So that was the passion. And I thought, why not write the book? So that's how the ideas took shape.
Fascinating. It's all connected, first principles thinking, building off of others' ideas, connecting stories. I really love that approach, Hari. You know, we're coming towards the close of this discussion. Just a couple of more questions before we let you go. Have you ever felt, I don't know what I'm doing with my life?
Never felt that I don't know what I'm doing with my life, but maybe at Tata Steel towards the end, I just may have got the feeling that I am stuck. So, and there is no way out of this place. So, at some point, those few years, I may have felt that feeling. So, I spent 14 years there. Probably the first 10 years, I really, 11 years, I really like 12 years, probably. Last 2 years, I was getting frustrated. In between, for 2, 3 years, also, I was frustrated. So, maybe out of 14 years, there were 4 years where I was a bit frustrated with myself, with what I was doing with my life. And I also felt helpless because I thought I was stuck in Jamshedpur. I don't know if you know India well and if you know Jamshedpur well. Jamshedpur those days did not even, there were no cell phones, there was no internet. There was no way you could communicate with the outside world. You had to use this heavy PNT, post and telegraph telephones. And not everybody had the PNT phones at home. So I thought, I'm really stuck at Tara Seel. I know I will retire at Tara Seel and I may not like it, but there's no way out. It's just that luck got me out of that place. So maybe 4 years or 14 and 4 years for the whole of my life, I felt I didn't know what I was doing with my life, but no other time.
Yeah, I think you've alluded to the other question I'm about to ask you, but still, how much of your success is a function of luck, and how much of it would you attribute to hard work and preparation?
I think hard work and preparation is inevitable. You have to do that because, I mean, some person has said this, and this is not what I am saying, and it's commonsensical as well, mathematically consistent, which is that the more number of times you try, the greater the probability of luck, meeting you. Because luck also has a probability of meeting you if you do a certain set of things. And if you keep doing those certain set of things, the probability that you encounter luck increases. So, I'll give you a real example of this. It might sound a bit trivial, but it's a real one. So towards the end of my years at Tara Seel, when I really wanted to get out, I thought this is it. And what did I do? I told you there was no internet, there was no phones, there was no way to access. The only way was you look at newspapers, you find a job, you apply for a job in the newspaper. Just imagine doing that in today's world. And every time I saw an ad in the paper, I diligently applied. One day I saw an ad in the paper saying that we are a search firm. You send us 1,000 rupees and we will send your CV to 500 companies. And I mean, this is such a silly ad. I just paid the 1,000 rupees, sent it. And they actually ended up sending it to a few companies. And I got a call from some companies, and this one of the companies was Daksh. And I ended up joining this company. And that was my amazing, journey with startup. One of the best companies I've ever worked for was Daksh. So it was just, me keeping on trying to do something. And eventually sending out by paying 1,000 rupees to some unknown advertiser and my CV reaching Daksh was all a chance thing. But it happened because I kept trying. I didn't give up, doing those things which were needed.
I'm sure as a person, professional, you've had some very difficult days. And now that you look back and with some objectivity, when you look at all of these difficult days put together, what's something that you did well that helped you navigate them? And what could have you done better?
What did I do well? So I think what I did well was I was a continuous learner. I continued to have the childlike curiosity. I continued to ask questions whichever domain I worked. I continued to explore and go deep. I was never happy with operating at the surface. So going deep, being curious, continuously learning in an environment where it was not very important. So, for example, Tata Steel is a large company. Their networking, managing your boss, managing bosses, colleagues, managing people at the top was very critical for success. And I'm not saying this in a complaining or negative way. In large companies, this is how it works. But I didn't do any of that because that was not what I was good at. I was not good at that kind of networking. So I stuck to my strengths. My strengths were what I outlined: extremely curious, continuously learning, going deep into things. So those were my strengths. I just continued to do what I was good at. I just didn't do what it took to be traditionally successful in that company. So I think that is something I have done well, if you ask, and that's something I continue to do. And I don't know whether I could have been more successful if I had done some things differently, or I'm more successful because I do this. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter at all. ultimately I'm happy because I continue to do things that I love to do. So happiness is what counts, and I'm happy because of that. Now, what I didn't do well, maybe, I don't know, it's difficult to say what I didn't do well. Many things I don't think I may have done well or quick enough. I mean, not have learned quick enough. What am I? I'm just trying to think.
That's fair. Maybe not learned quick enough, even though you try.
Yeah.
I love what Ray Dalio says, pain plus reflection equal to progress. And I think that's something that I got off while you were telling
and
us.
And maybe what I have not been able to do well continuously is, I don't know how to put it. Sometimes, you know, the world around you is not the way you want it to be. And that's perfectly all right. Why should the world around you be the way you want it to be? Why should we build around the principles that you value? So sometimes that has bothered me, and it has bothered me unreasonably to the extent sometimes I feel a little, I might come across as negative in some circumstances as a result of that. And I don't think I've been able to overcome that.
Fascinating. So, Hari, this has been a delightful discussion. Is there something that I should have asked you that I didn't? Or do you have a parting message for our community members from around the world or across age groups who are listening to this?
No, nothing, Utkarsh. I have nothing else to add. I think you've been such a wonderful host. I think the way you steered the discussion was absolutely amazing. I think I'm not as good as you made it out. The way you steered the conversation was so powerful that I think it brought out the best in me. And I don't have any parting advice. I think you guys are creating a wonderful community. These conversations are very interesting. And I just, I've just begun to read your book, and I've begun to understand what you're doing in Network Capital. I'm quite amazed that at such a young age, as a global citizen, you're putting together this community. And I like the way you named it, Network Capital. Capital is, network itself is the capital. So I think you guys are doing something very amazing, and I will learn more about what you're doing in the months to come.
Yeah. Thanks again, Hari. I look forward to, meeting you very soon. Really cherish your time. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Utkarsh. Thanks all.